a warrior, a king. At a whisper from the Merlin, he bent the knee before the Lady of the Lake. His face was reverential. No, of course, she thought. He hasn't seen Vivian before, only me, and I was in darkness. But he saw Morgaine next. She saw recognition move across his mobile features. He bowed to her, too. At least, she thought irrelevantly, where he was fostered they taught him manners befitting a king's son, and murmured, Morgaine. She bowed her head to him. He had known her even through the veil. Perhaps she should kneel to the king. But a lady of Avalon bends the knee to no human power. Merlin would kneel, and so would Kevin if he were asked. Vivian, never, for she was not only the priestess of the goddess, but incorporated the goddess within herself in a way the man-priests of male gods could never know or understand. And so Morgaine also would never kneel again. The Lady of the Lake held out her hand to him, bidding him rise. "You have had a long journey," she said, "and you are wearied. Morgaine, take him to my house and give him something to eat before we do this." He smiled then, not a king in the making, nor a chosen one, but just a hungry boy. "I thank you, lady." Inside Vivian's house, he thanked the priestesses who brought him food, and fell to hungrily. When he had satisfied his first hunger, he asked Morgaine, "Do you live here too?" "The lady dwells alone, but she is attended by the priestesses who serve her in turns. I have dwelt here with her when it was my turn to serve."
"You, a queen's daughter, you serve?"
She said austerely, "We must serve before we command. She herself served in her youth, and in her I serve the goddess." He considered that.
"I don't know this great goddess," he said at last. "The Merlin told me that the lady was our kinswoman."
"She is sister to Igraine, our mother."
"Why, then she is my aunt," Arthur said, trying the words out on his tongue as if they didn't quite fit. "All of this is so strange to me. Somehow I always try to think of Ectorius as my father, and Flavilla my mother. Of course I knew there was some secret, and because Ectorius wouldn't talk to me about it, I thought it must be something shameful, and I was a bastard, or worse. I don't remember Uther, my father, not at all. Nor my mother, not really. Though sometimes when Flavilla punished me, I used to dream I lived somewhere else, with a woman who petted me, then pushed me away. Is Igraine, our mother, much like you?"
"No, she is tall, red-haired," Morgaine said. Arthur sighed.
"And I suppose I don't remember her at all, for in my dreams it was someone like you. It was you."
He broke off. His voice had been trembling.
"Dangerous ground," Morgaine thought. "We dare not talk about that."
She said calmly, "Have another apple. They are grown on the island."
"Thank you."
He took one and bit into it.
"It's all so new and strange. So many things have happened to me since.
His voice faltered.
"I think of you all the time. I can't help myself. It was true what I said, Morgaine, that all my life I shall remember you because you were the first. And I shall always think of you and love you."
She knew she should say something hard and hurtful. Instead, she made her words kind but distant.
"You must not think of me in that way. For you, I am not a woman, but a representative of the goddess who came to you. And it is blasphemy to remember me as if I were only a mortal woman. Forget me, and remember the goddess. I've tried.
He broke off, clenching his fists, then said gravely,
You are right. That is the way to think of it. Only one more of the strange things that have come to me since I was sent for from Ectorius's house. Mysterious, magical things. Like the battle with the Saxons.
He held out his arm, rolling back the tunic to reveal a bandage thickly smeared with pine pitch already blackened.
I was wounded there. Only it was like a dream. My first battle. King Uther.
He looked down and swallowed.
I came too late. I never knew him. He lay in state in the church, and I saw him, dead, his weapons lying on the altar. They told me it was the custom that when a brave knight lay dead, his arms should watch with him. And then, even while the priest was chanting the Nunc Dimittis, all the alarm bells rang. There was a Saxon attack. The watchman came right into the church and snatched the bell ropes out of the hands of the monk who was tolling the passing bell to ring the alarm. And all the king's men caught up their arms and ran out. I had no sword, only my dagger. But I snatched up a spear from one of the soldiers. My first battle, I thought. But then Kai, my foster brother, Caius, Ectorius's son, he told me he had left his sword behind at their lodging, and I should run and fetch it for him. And I knew this was just a way to get me out of the battle. Kai and my foster father said I wasn't yet ready to be blooded. So instead of running back to the lodging house, I went into the church and snatched the king's sword off the stone bier. Well, he defended himself. He fought Saxons with it for 20 years. He'd certainly be glad to have it fight them again instead of lying useless on an old stone. So I ran off and was going to give it to Kai as we were all gathering against the attack. And then I saw the Merlin, and he said in the biggest voice I have ever heard, Where got you that sword, boy? And I was angry because he called me boy after what I'd done on Dragon Island. And I told him it was a sword for fighting Saxons, not for lying around on old stones. And then Ectorius came up and saw me with the sword in my hand, and then he and Kai both knelt down in front of me, just like that. I felt so strange. I said to him, Father, why are you kneeling? Why do you make my brother kneel like that? Oh, get up. This is terrible. And the Merlin said in that awful voice, He is the king. It is right he should have the sword. And then the Saxons came over the wall. We heard their horns, and there was no time to talk about swords or anything else. Kai grabbed up the spear, and I hung on to the sword, and off we went. I don't remember much about the battle. I suppose you never do. Kai was hurt. Badly hurt in the leg. Afterward, while the Merlin was bandaging up my arm, he told me who I really was. Who my father had been, that is. And Ectorius came and knelt and said he would be a good knight to me, as he had to my father and to Ambrosius. And I was so embarrassed. And the only thing he asked me was that I'd make Kai my chamberlain when I had a court. And of course, I said, I'd be glad to. After all, he's my brother. I mean, I'll always think of him as my brother. There was a lot of fuss about the sword, but the Merlin told all the kings that it was fate that had made me take it from the stone. And I tell you, they listened to him.
He smiled, and Morgaine felt a surge of love and pity at his confusion. The bells that had waked her. She had seen, but she hadn't known what she saw. She dropped her eyes. There would always be a bond between them now. Would any blow which struck him always fall like this? A sword into her naked heart.
"And now it seems I'm to get another sword," Arthur said. "From having no sword at all, suddenly I have two special ones."
He sighed and said almost plaintively, "I don't see what all this has to do with being a king." As often as she had seen Vivian in the robes of the High Priestess of Avalon, Morgaine had never grown used to the sight. She saw Arthur look back and forth between them, and saw the likeness mirrored in his eyes. He was silent, awed once more. At least, thought Morgaine, feeling an empty sickness again, they didn't make him keep the magical fast. Perhaps she should have eaten with him, but the thought of food made her feel queasy. Prolonged work with magic could do that. No wonder Vivian was so emaciated. "Come," Vivian said, and leading the way, the Lady of Avalon in her own place preceded even a king, she passed from the house and along the shores of the lake and into the building where the priests were housed. Arthur walked quietly at Morgaine's side, and for an instant she half expected him to reach out his hand, as he had done when he was very little, clinging to hers. But now that little hand she had held was a warrior's hand, bigger than her own, hardened with long practice at swordplay and with other weapons. Behind Arthur and Morgaine came the Merlin, and at his side, Kevin. Down a narrow flight of steps they went, and the dank smell of underground surrounded them. Morgaine didn't see anyone strike a light, but suddenly there was a tiny glow in the darkness, and a pale light flared around them. Vivian stopped so abruptly that they jostled into her, and for an instant Morgaine was surprised that she felt simply soft and small, an ordinary woman's body, not a remote image of the goddess. The lady reached out and took Arthur's wrist in her small dark hand. It did not come near to reaching around his. "Arthur, son of Igraine of Avalon, and of Pendragon, rightful king of all Britain," she said. "Behold the most sacred things in all your land." The light flared on gold and jewels in cup and platter, the long spear, the crimson and gold and silver threads of the scabbard. And from the scabbard Vivian drew forth the long dark blade. Dimly stones glinted in its hilt. "The sword of the sacred regalia of the Druids," she said quietly. "Swear now to me, Arthur Pendragon, King of Britain, that when you come to your crown, you will deal fairly with Druid as with Christian, and that you will be guided by the sacred magic of those who have set you on this throne." Arthur reached for the sword, his eyes wide. Morgaine could see it in his eyes, that he knew what manner of sword this was. Vivian made a quick gesture, preventing him. "It is death to touch the holy things unprepared," she said. "Arthur, swear. With this sword in your hand, there is no chieftain or king, pagan or Christian, who will stand against you. But this is no sword for a king who is bound to hear only the Christian priests. If you will not swear, you may depart now, bearing such weapons as you can get from your Christian followers. And the folk who look to Avalon for their rule shall follow you only when we bid them to do so. Or will you swear and have their allegiance to the sacred weapons of Avalon? Choose, Arthur." He stared at her, frowning a little, the pale light glinting on his hair, which looked almost white. He said, "There can be only one ruler in this land. I must not be ruled from Avalon." "Nor must you be ruled by the priests who would make you a pawn of their dead god," said Vivian quietly. "But we will not urge you. Choose whether or no you will take this sword, or refuse it
and rule in your own name, despising the help of the old gods. Morgaine saw that strike home. The day when he had run among the deer and the old gods had given him victory, so that he was acclaimed king among these people, the first to acclaim him. He said quickly, "God forbid I should despise," and stopped, swallowing hard. "What must I swear, lady?" "Only this, to deal fairly with all men, whether or no they follow the God of the Christians, and always to reverence the gods of Avalon. For whatever the Christians say, Arthur Pendragon, and whatever they may call their god, all the gods are as one god, and all the goddesses but one goddess. Swear only to be true to that truth, and not to cling to one and despise another." "You have seen," said the Merlin, his voice deep and resonant in the silence, "that I do truly reverence the Christ, and that I have knelt at the altar and shared their sacred meal." Arthur said, troubled, "Why, that's true, my Lord Merlin, and you, I think, are the counsellor I shall trust more than any other. Do you bid me swear, then?"
"My lord and king," said Taliesin, "you are young for this rule, and perhaps your priests and bishops would presume to keep the conscience even of a king. But I am not a priest. I am a druid, and I say only that wisdom and truth are not the special property of any priest. Ask your own conscience, Arthur, if it would be wrong to swear to deal fairly with all men and whatever gods they worship, instead of swearing allegiance to one only."
Arthur said quietly, "Well, then, I will swear, and take the sword."
"Kneel, then," Vivian said, "in token that a king is but a man, and a priestess, even a high priestess, no more than a woman, but that the gods are over us all." Arthur knelt. The light on his fair hair, Morgaine thought, was like a crown. Vivian laid the sword in his hand. His fists closed around the hilt. He drew a long breath.
"Take this sword, my king," Vivian said, "and bear it in justice. This sword was not made of iron, raped from the body of the earth, our mother. It is holy, forged of metal which fell from the heavens, so long ago that even the tradition of the druids keeps no accurate account of the years. For it was forged before there were druids in these islands."
Arthur rose, the sword in his hand.
"Which do you like better?" asked Vivian. "The sword or the scabbard?"
Arthur looked admiringly at the richly worked scabbard, but he said,
"I'm a warrior, my lady. The scabbard is beautiful, but I like the sword better."
"Even so," Vivian said, "keep the scabbard always by you. It was wrought with all the magic of Avalon. While you bear that scabbard, even though you take a wound, you will not shed enough blood to endanger your life. It is set about with blood-staunching spells. It is a rare and precious thing, and magical."
He smiled, saying, almost laughing with the breaking of the long tension,
"Would I had had it when I took this wound against the Saxons. I bled like a sheep in the slaughter-house." "You were not then a king, my lord, but now the magical scabbard will protect you."
"Even so, my king," said
Kevin the bard, shadowed behind the Merlin.
"However much you trust in the scabbard, I advise you to get yourself arms masters and cease not to practice with weapons."
Arthur chuckled as he belted on sword and scabbard.
"Never doubt it, sir. My foster father had me taught to read by an old priest who read to me from one of the Gospels how the devil tempted the Lord Jesus, telling him that God had given him angels to watch over him, and Jesus said that it was ill done to tempt God. And a king is no more than flesh and blood. Remember,
I took my first sword from where Uther was lying dead. Don't think I shall tempt God that way, Lord Druid.
Somehow, with the sword of the sacred regalia belted at his waist, Arthur seemed taller, more impressive.
Morgaine could see him crowned and robed as a king, seated upon his high seat. And for a moment, around him, it seemed that the small room was thronged with other men, shadowy, armed, richly clad, noble, standing around him closely, his companions. Then they were gone, and he was only a young man again, smiling uncertainly, wearing his rank a little uneasily as yet. They turned and left the underground chapel. But before they passed completely out of the room, Arthur turned back for a moment to look at the other things of the regalia lying in shadow. His uncertainty could be seen on his face, the almost visible question, "Did I do right? Am I blaspheming the god I was taught to worship as the only one?" The voice of Taliesin was low and gentle.
"Know you my dearest wish, my lord and king?"
"What, Lord Merlin?"
"That one day, not now, for the land is not yet ready for it, and neither are those who follow Christ, but one day, druid and priest should worship as one, that within their great church, their sacred Eucharist should be celebrated with yonder cup and dish to hold their bread and wine, in token that all the gods are as one."
Arthur crossed himself and said, almost in a whisper,
"Amen to that, Lord Merlin, and holy Jesus make it possible one day in these islands."
Morgaine felt the prickling up and down her forearms, and heard herself say, without knowing that she spoke until the sight spoke through her,
"That day will come, Arthur, but not as you think. Beware about how you bring that day to pass, for it may be a sign to you that your work is done."
Arthur said in a hushed voice,
"If that day should ever come to pass, lady, then indeed it will be a sign to me that I have done what I came to the throne to do, and I am content to have it so."
"Beware what you speak," said the Merlin very softly, "for indeed the words we speak make shadows of what is to come. And by speaking them, we bring them to pass, my king."
Morgaine blinked as they came into the sunlight. She swayed on her feet, and Kevin reached out a hand to steady her.
"Are you ill, my lady?"
She shook her head impatiently, willing the blurring behind her eyes to vanish.
Arthur looked at her, troubled. But then they were all in the sunshine, and his mind returned to the business at hand.
"I'm to be crowned at Glastonbury on the Isle of the Priests. If it is possible for you to leave Avalon, lady, will you be there?"
Vivian smiled at him and said, "I think not, but the Merlin shall go with you, and Morgaine shall see your crowning if you wish, and she wishes," she added, and Morgaine wondered why the lady spoke so and why she was smiling.
"Morgaine, my child, will you go with them in the barge?"
Morgaine bowed. She stood in the prow as the boat moved toward the shore, bearing now only Arthur and the Merlin, and as it neared shore she saw several armed men awaiting him. She saw the awe in their eyes as the draped boat of Avalon appeared quite suddenly from the mists, and one of them she recognized. Lancelot hadn't changed from that day 2 years ago, only he was taller, more handsome, dressed richly in dark crimson, bearing sword and shield. He recognized her as well and bowed.
"Cousin," he said. "You know my sister, the Lady Morgaine, Duchess of Cornwall, Priestess of Avalon," said Arthur. "Morgaine, this is my dearest friend, our cousin. We have met."
Lancelot bent over her hand, and again, through the uneasy sickness in her,
Morgain felt a sudden thrust of that longing that would never really leave her.
He and I were meant one for the other. I should have had the courage that day, even though it meant the breaking of a vow.
She could see in his eyes that he remembered, in the tenderness with which he touched her hand. Then she sighed, raised her eyes, and was introduced to the others.
"My foster brother, Kai," Arthur said. Kai was big and dark and Roman to the core, and she saw as he spoke to Arthur with natural deference and affection that here, indeed, Arthur had two strong chiefs to lead his armies.
The other knights were introduced as Bedwyr, Lucan, and Balin, which name made Morgain and the Merlin, too, lift their eyes in surprise. This was foster brother to Vivian's older son, Balin. Balin was fair-haired and broad-shouldered, in ragged clothing, but he moved as gracefully as his half-brother Lancelot. His dress was poor, but his weapons and armour were bright and well-kept, and looked well-used. Morgain was content to leave Arthur to his knights, but first he raised her hand to his lips ceremoniously and kissed it.
"Come to my crowning if you can, sister," he said.
Chapter 19. A few days later, Morgain went forth, with a few of the people of Avalon, to the crowning of Arthur. Never in all her years upon Avalon, except for the few moments when she had opened the mists to allow Guinevere to find her convent again, had she set foot on the earth of the Isle of the Priests, Anis Witrin, the Isle of Glass. It seemed to her that the sun shone with a curious harshness, unlike the soft and misty sunlight of Avalon. She had to remind herself that to almost all the people of Britain, this was the real world, and the land of Avalon only an enchanted dream, as if it were the very kingdom of faery. To her, Avalon alone was real, and this last but a harsh dream from which, for some reason, she did not now waken. All the space before the church seemed to have sprouted colourful tents and pavilions like strange mushrooms. To Morgain it seemed that the bells of the churches rang day and night, hour upon hour, a jangling sound that oppressed her nerves. Arthur greeted her, and for the first time she met Ectorius, the good knight and warrior who had fostered her brother and his wife Flavilla. For this venture into the world outside, at Vivian's advice, Morgain had laid aside the blue robes of an Avalon priestess and the spotted deerskin overtunic, and had put on a simple dress of black wool with linen underdress in white, and a white veil over her braided hair. Soon she realized that this made her look like a matron. Among the British women, young maidens went with their hair unbound and wore dresses dyed in bright colors. They all took her for one of the women from the nunnery on Anis Witrin, near to the church, where the sisters wore such somber robes. Morgain said nothing to undeceive them, nor, although he lifted his eyebrows and grinned at her, did Arthur. To Flavilla he said, "Foster mother, too many things are to be done. The priests want to speak to me of my soul, and the King of Orkney and the King of North Wales want audience with me. Will you take my sister to our mother, then?"
"To our mother," Morgain thought, "but that mother has become a stranger to us both."
She looked in her mind for any joy in this meeting, and found none. Igraine had been content to let both her children go, the child of her first joyless marriage, the love child of her second. What manner of woman could she be then? Morgain found that she was stiffening her mind and heart against the first sight of Igraine.
"I do not," she thought, "even remember her face."
Yet when she did see Igraine, she realized that she would have known her anywhere. Morgain! She had forgotten, or remembered only in dreams, how rich and warm was Igraine's voice. "My darling child, Why, you are a woman grown.
I see you always in my heart as a little maiden.
And how worn and sleepless you look.
Has all this ceremony been heavy on you, Morgaine?
Morgaine kissed her mother, again feeling tears choking at the back of her throat.
Igraine was beautiful, and she herself, again words from a half-memory flooded her mind,
little and ugly like one of the fairy folk.
Did Igraine think her ugly too?
But what is this? Igraine's light hands touched the crescent on her brow. Painted like one of the fairy people? Is this seemly, Morgaine?
Morgaine's voice was stiff.
I am a priestess of Avalon, and I wear the mark of the goddess with pride.
Fold your veil over it, then, child, or you will offend the abbess. You are to lodge with me in the nunnery.
Morgaine set her mouth hard.
Would the abbess, if she came to Avalon, keep her cross out of sight for fear of offending me or the lady?
I don't wish to offend you, mother, but it would not be suitable for me to lodge within the walls of a nunnery. The abbess wouldn't like it, nor would the lady, and I am under the lady's orders and live under her laws.
The thought of dwelling within those walls, even for the 3 nights of the crowning, called to come and go night and day by the hellish jangling of those bells, made her blood run cold.
Igraine looked troubled.
Well, it shall be as you wish. Perhaps you could be lodged with my sister, the Queen of Orkney. Do you remember Morgawes?
I will be glad to have my kinswoman Morgaine, said a soft voice. And Morgaine looked up to see the very image of her own mother as she remembered her from her own childhood, stately, robed richly in bright silks, with jewels and hair braided into a bright coronal on her brow.
Why, you were such a little girl! Now you are grown, and a priestess.
Morgaine was folded into a warm and scented embrace.
Welcome, kinswoman. Come here and sit by me. How does our sister Vivian? We hear great things of her, that she is the moving force behind all the great events which have brought Igraine's son to the throne. Even Lot couldn't stand against one backed by the Merlin and the fairy folk and all the tribes and all the Romans.
And so your little brother is to be king. Will you come to court, Morgaine, and advise him, as Uther would have been well advised to have the Lady of Avalon do?
Morgaine laughed, relaxing into Morgawes's embrace.
A king will do as seems good to him. That is the first lesson which all who come near him must know.
I suppose Arthur is like enough to Uther to learn that without much lessoning.
Aye, there's not much doubt who had his fathering now, for all the talk there was about it then, Morgawes said,
and drew breath in swift compunction.
No, Igraine, you must not weep again. It should be joy to you, not sorrow, that your son is so much like his father, and accepted everywhere in all of Britain, because he has pledged himself to rule all the lands and peoples.
Igraine blinked. She had, Morgaine thought, been doing over much weeping in the last days. She said,
I'm happy for Arthur.
But her voice choked, and she couldn't speak again.
Morgaine stroked her mother's arm, but she felt impatient. Always, always, ever since she could remember, her mother had had no thought for her children, only for Uther.
Uther.
Even now, when he was dead and lay in his grave, her mother would push her and Arthur aside for the memory of the man she had loved enough to make her forget everything else.
With relief, she turned back to Morgawes.
Vivian said you had sons.
True. Morgaine said, though most of them are still young enough to be here among the women. But the oldest is here to pledge loyalty to his king. Should Arthur die in battle, and not even Uther was immune to that fate, my Gawain is his nearest kinsman,
Unless you already have a son, Morgaine?
No.
Have the priestesses of Avalon embraced chastity like nuns, then? That at your age you have given the goddess neither son nor daughter? Or have you shared your mother's fate and lost many children at birth? Oh, forgive me, Igraine. I did not mean to remind you.
Igraine blinked back tears.
I should not weep against God's will. I have more than many women. I have a daughter who serves the goddess to whom I was reared, and a son who will tomorrow be crowned with his father's crown. My other children are in the bosom of Christ.
Name of the goddess, thought Morgaine. What a way to think of a god with all the generations of the dead clinging to him.
She knew it was only a way of speaking, a comfort to a sorrowing mother, yet the blasphemy of the idea troubled her. She remembered that Morgaine had asked her a question and shook her head.
No, I have borne no children, Morgaine. Until this year at Beltane I was kept virgin for the goddess.
She stopped abruptly. She should say no more. Igraine, who was more Christian than Morgaine could have believed, would have been horrified at the thought of the rite in which she had played the part of the goddess for her own brother. And then a second horror swept over her, worse than the first, so that she felt a wave of sickness follow in its wake. It had come about at full moon, and though the moon had waned and filled and waned again, her moon-dark bleeding had not yet come upon her, nor showed any sign it was about to do so. She had been relieved that she wouldn't have this nuisance at the crowning, and had thought it was reaction to the great magic. No other explanation had suggested itself to her until this moment. A rite for the renewal and fertility of crops and land, and of the wombs of the women of the tribe. She had known that. Yet such had been her blindness and her pride, she had thought that perhaps the priestess, the goddess, would be exempted from the purpose of this ritual. Yet she had seen other young priestesses sicken and grow pale after these rites, until they began to bloom with their own ripening fruit. She had seen the children born, had brought some of them to birth with her own trained priestess hands. Yet never once in her stupid blindness had it entered her mind that she too might come away from the ritual with a womb grown heavy. She saw Morgause's sharp eyes on her, and deliberately drew a long breath and yawned to cover her silence.
"I've been travelling since daybreak," she said, "and have not breakfasted. I'm hungry."
And Igraine apologised and sent her women for bread and barley beer, which Morgaine forced herself to eat, though the food made her feel faintly sick, and now she knew why.
"Goddess! Mother goddess! Vivien knew this might come about, yet she did not spare me."
She knew what must be done, and done as quickly as possible. Yet it couldn't be done in the 3 days of Arthur's crowning, for she had no access to the roots and herbs she could find in Avalon, and furthermore, she dared not be sick now. She felt herself shrinking from the violence and sickness. Yet it must be done, and done without delay, or in midwinter she would bear a son to her own mother's son. Furthermore, Igraine must know nothing of it. The thought would strike her as evil beyond imagining. Morgaine forced herself to eat and to talk of small things, and gossip like any woman. But her mind didn't rest as she talked. Yes, the fine linen she wore had been woven in Avalon. There was no linen anywhere like it. Perhaps it was the flax of the lake, which grew stronger, longer fibres, and whiter than anywhere else. But in her heart she was thinking, "Arthur, he must never know. He has enough to weigh his heart at this crowning. If I can bear this burden and keep silence to give his heart ease, I will do so." Yes, She'd been taught to play the harp. Why, how foolish, Mother, to think it was wrong for a woman to make music. Even if one of the scriptures did say that women were to keep silence in the church, it was shocking to think that the ears of God could be offended with the voice of a woman singing his praises. Had not his own mother lifted up her voice to sing praises when she knew she was to bear a child by the Holy Spirit? Then, when Morgain took the harp in her hands and sang for her mother, beneath the refrain lay despair, for she knew as well as Vivian that she was to be the next Lady of Avalon, and she owed the goddess a daughter at least. It was impious to cast out a child conceived under the great marriage. But how could she do anything else? The mother of the Christian god had rejoiced in the god that had given her a child, but Morgaine could only rage in silent bitterness against the god who had taken the form of her unknown brother. She was used to living her life on two levels at once, but even so the effort made her lips pale and her voice strained, and she was glad when Morgause cut her short. "Morgaine, your voice is lovely. I hope to hear it at my own court. Andy Grain, I hope to see you many times before the crowning feast is ended, but I must return and see how my babe is cared for. I have no love for convent bells, and much praying either, and Morgaine looks weary with travelling. I think I shall take her away to my tents, and make her lie down, so she will be fresh in the morning to see Arthur crowned." Igraine hardly troubled to conceal her relief. "Yes, I should be at the noonday office," she said. "You know, both of you, that when Arthur is crowned, I shall dwell in the nunnery at Tintagel in Cornwall. Arthur asked me to remain with him, but soon I hope he will have a queen of his own, and no need of me." Yes, they would insist that Arthur be wedded, and soon. Morgaine wondered which of these petty kings would manage the honour of being the king's father-in-law. "And my son might have been the heir to a crown." "No, no, I will not even think of that." And again bitter anger overcame her like choking. Why had Vivian done this to her? To set all this in motion so that they too, Arthur and Morgaine, might play out some mummery of gods and goddesses? Was it no more than that? Igraine kissed and embraced them both, promising to see them again afterward. As they walked along the path toward the brilliant array of pavilions, Morgause said, "Igraine is so changed. I wouldn't have known her. Who would have ever thought she would grow so pious? No doubt she will end her days as the terror of a whole sisterhood of nuns, and although I grieve to say it, I must rejoice I am not one of them. I have no call to a nunnery." Morgaine forced herself to smile and say, "No, I suppose not. Marriage and motherhood seem to have agreed with you. You blossom like the wild roses of the hedge, aunt." Morgause smiled lazily. "My husband is good to me, and it suits me well to be a queen," she said. "He is one of the Northmen, and so he doesn't think it wrong to take counsel of a woman, as these fools of Romans do. I hope Arthur has not been all spoiled by dwelling in a Roman household. It might have made him mighty in war, but if he despises the tribes, he will not rule. Even Uther was wise enough to know that, and to have himself crowned on Dragon Island." "So was Arthur," said Morgaine. It was all she could say.
"True. I've heard something of that, and I think he's wise. As for me, I am ambitious. Lot seeks my counsel, and all goes well in our land. The priests are very sour about me, and say I do not keep my place as befits a woman. No doubt they think I am some kind of evil sorceress or witch, because I do not sit modestly at my spinning and weaving.
But Lot thinks little of the priests, though his people are Christian enough. To tell the truth, most of them care not whether the god of this land is the white Christ, or the goddess, or the horned one, or the horse god of the Saxons, so long as their crops grow and their bellies are full. I think that is just as well. A land ruled by priests is a land filled with tyrants on earth and in heaven. Uther leaned a bit too far in that direction these last years, if you ask me. The goddess grant that Arthur has more sense.
He swore to deal justly by the gods of Avalon before Vivian gave him the sword of the Druids.
Did she so? Morgause said. Now I wonder what brought that to her mind. But enough of gods and kings and all of that. Morgaine, what ails you?
And when Morgaine didn't answer,
do you think I can't tell a breeding woman when I see one? Igraine didn't see it, but she has eyes now only for her grief.
Morgaine forced herself to say lightly, well, it might be so. I went to the rites at Beltane.
Morgause chuckled. If that was your first time, you might not know for a moon or so. But good fortune to you. You are already past your best childbearing years. At your age, I had three. I wouldn't advise telling Igraine. She's far too Christian to accept a child to the goddess now. Oh, well, I suppose all women grow old in time. Vivian, too, must be well on in years now. I haven't seen her since Gawain was born.
She seems much the same to me as always, Morgaine said.
And so she didn't come to Arthur's crowning. Well, we can manage without her. But I don't think she will be content to stay long in the background. One day, I doubt it not, she will put her will to seeing the cauldron of the goddess rather than the sharing cup of the Christians' love feast on our altar at court. And I won't weep when that day comes, either.
Morgaine felt a prophetic shiver as she saw in her mind the robed priest raising the cup of the mysteries before the altar of Christ. And clearly, before her eyes then, she saw Lancelot kneeling, a light on his face such as she had never seen. She shook her head to clear it of the unwanted sight. The day of Arthur's crowning dawned brilliant and shining. All night they had come from the length and breadth of Britain to see the High King crowned here on the Isle of the Priests. There were crowds of the little dark people, tribesmen clad in skins and checkered cloth and adorned with the dull-coloured stones from the north, red-haired and tall and bearded. And more than any other, the Roman peoples of the civilised lands. And there were tall, fair, broad-shouldered men, Angles and Saxons from the treaty troops, who had been settled south in Kent and had come to renew the broken allegiance. The slopes were lined solid. Even at Beltane festivals, Morgaine had never seen so many people in one place, and she felt frightened. She herself had a privileged place, with Igraine, Lot, Morgause, and her sons, and the family of Ectorius. King Lot, slender and dark and charming, bent over her hand and embraced her, and made a great show of calling her kinswoman and niece. But Morgaine, looking behind the superficial smile, saw the sullen bitterness in Lot's eyes. He had schemed and intrigued to prevent this day. Now his son, Gawain, was to be proclaimed Arthur's nearest heir. Would that satisfy his ambition, or would he continue to work to undermine the authority of the High King? Morgaine slitted her eyes at Lot, and discovered she didn't like him at all. Then the bells rang from the church, and a cry went up all along the slopes overlooking the flatland before the church. And out of the church door a slender youth was walking, the sun glinting on his shining hair. Arthur, thought Morgaine, their young king like a hero out of legend,
with that great sword in his hand. Although she could hear no words from where she sat, she saw the priest place on his head Uther's slender golden circlet. Arthur raised the sword in his hand and said something she couldn't hear, but it was repeated from mouth to mouth, and when she heard it, Morgaine felt the same thrill she had felt seeing him come victorious and crowned from the victory over the king's stag. "For all the peoples of Britain," he had said, "my sword for your protection, and my hand for justice." But Merlin came forward in his white robes of state. Next to the venerable Bishop of Glastonbury, he looked mild and gentle. Arthur bowed briefly to them both, taking each of them by the hand. "The goddess put it into his head to do that," Morgaine thought, and in a moment she heard Lot saying as much.
"Damned clever, that, to set the Merlin and the bishop side by side in token that he'll be advised by both."
Morgaine said, "I don't know who had the teaching of him, but believe me, Uther had no foolish son."
"It's our turn," Lot said, rising to his feet, holding out his hand to Morgaine. "Come, lady, don't mind worrying that old crew of greybeards and priests. I've no shame to confess you sit at my side as my equal in all things. Shame to Uther that he didn't do likewise with your sister."
Morgaine's smile twisted. "Perhaps it is our good fortune that Igraine had not the strength of will to insist on it." Morgaine rose to her feet, driven by a sudden impulse, and went forward with them. Lot and Morgaine motioned her courteously to precede them. Though she didn't kneel, she bowed her head slightly. "I bring you the homage of Avalon, my lord Arthur, and of those who serve the goddess." Behind her she could hear the priests murmuring, see Igraine among the black-robed sisters from the convent. She heard Igraine as if her mother had spoken. Bold, forward, she was headstrong even as a child. She forced herself not to hear. She was a priestess of Avalon, not one of those house-bound hens of God. "I welcome you for yourself and for Avalon, Morgaine." Arthur took her by the hand and placed her near where he stood. "I do you all honour as the only other child of my mother, and Duchess of Cornwall in your own right, dear sister." He released her hand, and she bent her head to keep herself from fainting, because her eyes had blurred and her head swam. "Why must I feel like this now? Arthur's doing." "No, not his. The doing of the goddess. It is her will, not ours." Lot stepped forward, kneeling before Arthur, and Arthur raised him.
"Welcome, dear uncle."
The same dear uncle, Morgaine thought, who, if I'm not mistaken, would gladly have seen him die as an infant.
"Lot of Orkney, will you keep your shores against the Northmen, and come to my aid if the shores of Britain are threatened?" "I will, kinsman, I swear it." "Then I bid you keep the throne of Orkney and Lothian in peace, and never will I claim it, or fight against you for it," said Arthur,
and bent slightly to kiss Lot on the cheek.
"May you and your lady rule well and long in the north, kinsman."
Lot, rising, said, "I beg leave to present you a knight for your company.
I beg you to make him one of your companions, Lord Arthur. My son, Gawain."
Gawain was big, tall and strongly built, rather like a male version of Igraine and Morgaine herself. Red curls crowned his head, and though he wasn't much older than Arthur himself, in fact, Morgaine thought, he must have been a little younger, for Morgaine hadn't wedded Lot until Arthur was born. He was already a young giant, 6 feet tall. He knelt before Arthur, and Arthur raised him and embraced him.
"Welcome, cousin. I will gladly make you the first of my companions.
"I hope you will join and be welcomed by my dearest friends," he said, and nodded to the three young men standing at one side.
"Lancelot, Gawain is our cousin. This is Kai, and this Bedwyr. They are my foster brothers. Now I have companions, even as did that Alexander of the Greeks."
Morgaine stood and watched all that day as kings from all over Britain came to pledge fealty to the throne of the High King and swear to join him in war and to defend their shores. Fair-haired King Pellinore, lord of the Lake Country, came to bend the knee before Arthur and begged to take leave even before the end of the feasting.
"What, Pellinore?" said Arthur, laughing. "You, who I thought would be my staunchest supporter here, to desert me so soon?"
"I've had news from my homeland, lord, that a dragon is raging there. I would swear to follow it until I have killed it."
Arthur embraced him and handed him a gold ring.
"I will keep no king from his own people when they have need of him." "Go and see to the killing of the dragon, then, and bring me its head when you have killed it."
It was nearing sunset when at last all the kings and nobles who had come to swear allegiance to their high king had finished. Arthur was no more than a boy, but he stood through the long afternoon with unflagging courtesy, speaking to each person who came as if he had been the first. Only Morgaine, trained in Avalon to read faces, could see the traces of weariness. But at last it was over, and servants began to bring the feast. Morgaine had expected Arthur to sit down to dine among the circle of youths he had appointed as his companions. It had been a long day. He was young, and he had done his duty with concentrated attention all day. Instead, he sat among the bishops and elder kings of his father's council. Morgaine was pleased to see that the Merlin was among them. After all, Taliesin was his own grandsire, although she wasn't sure that Arthur knew that. When he had eaten, and he stuffed himself like a hungry boy who was still growing, he rose and began to make his way among the guests. In his plain white tunic, adorned only with the slender gold coronet, he stood out among the brightly dressed kings and nobles like a white deer in a dark forest. His companions came at his side, the huge young Gawain, and Kai, dark, with Roman hawk-like features, and a sardonic smile. As he came closer, Morgaine saw that he had a scar at the corner of his mouth, still red and ugly, which drew his face up into an ugly leer. It was a pity. He had probably been good-looking before that. Lancelot, next to him, looked pretty as a girl. No. Something fierce, masculine and beautiful. Perhaps a wildcat. Morgause looked at him with a greedy eye.
"Morgaine, who is that beautiful young man? The one beside Kai and Gawain. The one in crimson."
Morgaine laughed. "Your nephew, aunt. Vivian's son, Galahad. But the Saxons named him Elf Arrow, and mostly he's called Lancelot."
"Who would have thought that Vivian, who is so plain, should have such a handsome son?
Her older son, Balin. Now he isn't handsome. Rugged, strong and hearty, and trustworthy as an old dog.
But he's like Vivian.
No one alive could call her beautiful."
The words cut Morgaine to the heart. "I am said to be like Vivian. Does everyone think me ugly, then?"
"That girl said little and ugly as one of the fairy folk."
She said coldly,
"I think Vivian very beautiful."
Morgause snickered.
"It's easy to see you've been reared in Avalon, which is even more isolated than most nunneries. I don't think you know what men desire for beauty in a woman."
"Come now," said Igraine soothingly. "There are virtues other than beauty. This Lancelot has his mother's eyes, and no one has ever denied that Vivian's eyes are beautiful. Vivian has so much charm that no one knows or cares whether or no she is beautiful. Only that she has pleased them with her beautiful eyes and her fine voice. Beauty isn't only in Queen